Good morning and welcome to Spotlight on Industry. I'm your host, Sam Mason. Spotlight on Industry is a program where we take you inside our region's manufacturing plants and processing facilities so that we can learn about the goods they produce, where they go when they leave the plant, and the impact these facilities have on our local economies. One thing we've learned is that manufacturing comes in many shapes and sizes. So far on this program, we've heard how coils of steel are drawn into straight bars and wire, and we've heard the sounds of gasoline engines being assembled in a nearly 1 million square foot facility. This month, we scale it back a bit to a smaller company just east of Maryville, whose products are designed to contain everything from tape, plastic wrap, aluminum foil, fishing rods, and high explosives. Karen and I headed over to Albany, Missouri to visit with Diane and Heath Higdon of GHS Paper Tube and Core to learn how they turn spools of paper into rigid tubes that have a variety of uses. We'll also hear how that business has survived a tornado, a fire, and a down economy, and lived to tell the tale. We're also going to add a new feature to the program this month. My producer, Karen Lawrence, had a chance to visit with Sister Lynn D'Souza of the Benedictine Sisters of Perpetual Adoration in Clyde, Missouri. Some of you may be familiar with the sisters and have had a chance to visit the monastery. What you may not know is that they are a leading provider of altar breads that are shipped around the globe. We'll hear that interview later in the show. Stick around as we shine the spotlight on industry.
Support for Spotlight on Industry on KXCV KRNW comes from Nottoway County Economic Development. Coordinating economic development services for the City of Maryville, Nottoway County, and the Maryville Industrial Development Corporation. Their services include finance and incentives development, site location, industrial development, and small business assistance. More at maryvillemo.org. And from Mazingo Lake Recreation Park. The park provides Nottoway County residents and visitors with an 18-hole golf course, driving range, and a 9-hole junior course coming 2015. More on Mazingo's golf offerings is at mazingolake.com. Support also comes from the City of Maryville, Missouri, offering residents and visitors opportunities in education, employment, health care, and recreation, as well as agricultural, industrial, retail, and professional services. More information about the City of Maryville is at www.maryville.org.
Welcome back to Spotlight on Industry. I'm Sam Mason. If you're just joining us, this month we shine the spotlight on GHS Paper Tube and Core in Albany, Missouri. I had a chance to sit down with owner and president, Diane Higdon, to learn about the company and some very challenging obstacles that they've overcome. Good morning, Diane, and welcome to Spotlight on Industry.
Good morning and welcome to Albany.
Well, before we talk about the history of the company and your involvement, tell us just a little bit about paper tubes and cores.
Well, paper tubes and cores are used in a various industry. It ranges from mail order to shipping tubes to tape and label. We hit several different industries. One of our largest accounts is Bass Pro. Most people know who that is. They're located down in Springfield. We have their contract on any tube that's needed for mailing of a fishing rod will be mailed out of their mail order warehouse. So we do have that account, and they're a big account for us. We do a lot with the explosives industry. We supply the casings for dynamite, and we are very involved in an ice road project that goes on every year. And it's kind of exciting, but it's kind of stressful trying to meet the deadline. So it's in a variety of different industries that we supply them to.
So tell me about this company and when it was established.
The original company was established in 1979. It was located in Stanbury, Missouri. The original owner, his name was Ben Rogers. He established the company, and at the time it was called Industrial Lumber Company, and he was doing reels, wooden reels. And with those wooden reels, he was needing a core to put the two reels together. And that's how it originated. And then he changed the name somewhere in the 80s, I believe, to Rogers Manufacturing. And Rogers Manufacturing started making just paper tubes and cores. And he kind of went away from the lumber industry. And then in 2002, a couple of buddies of mine from the steel industry, I grew up in the steel industry. I sold for LMP Steel and Wire in Maryville for years. And we got together and we bought the company in 02. And at that time, it changed the name to GHS Paper Tube and Core.
And what does GHS stand for?
That at the time was the initials of the original three.
Okay.
That bought in. It is now just two. The H and the G are still part of the ownership. And then there's a holding company out of Kansas City that is a partner, but a silent partner.
Let's talk a little bit more about your products and what they're used for. You mentioned a couple of things, and I know there's a common misconception out there that you make toilet paper rollers. and I made that mistake myself when you and I first talked. So do you want to set the record straight on
yes,
that?
Yes, I do. Actually, everyone believes that we make paper tube or toilet paper rolls and paper towel rolls. Most of the big industries that produce those items make their own tubes, simply because they're a very small tube and they can do them in-house. We get into a lot of heavy wall. We do for the beef producers and for the pork producers, we do a lot of foils, a lot of plastic wrap. If you get into your cabinet every day and get out aluminum foil, then you're probably going to see some tubes that come out of Albany. We do a lot of foils that are for greeting cards. When you're buying a greeting card, you'll see the little foil etchings on there. There's a lot of industries out there that make the foil for that, and they roll it up on a tube. And we have a big account out in Kansas that makes that type of foil. We do a lot with posters and calendars, a lot of shipping tubes for posters and calendars.
Okay.
So, yeah. We do not do anything for toilet paper.
and then there's one other industry that we talked about that you don't do anything with.
That is the fireworks industry. The liability on fireworks is extremely high. Insurance rates are extremely high. We do a lot with the explosives industry, but we have trained professionals that are lighting and detonating all of that. With fireworks, you do not have any control on who is setting off the firework. And believe me, if something happens bad, it goes all the way back to whoever made that casing. So the liability, I walk away from it. Yes, it could be a huge business force, but no, we walk away from it.
So those manufacturers that make fireworks, are those also industries where they make their own tubes and cores?
Some of them, you'll find some of the large companies will do that. A lot of the casings for fireworks are imported. I know very few companies similar to mine that will even participate in the business.
So your tubes are what size? What's the smallest diameter to the largest diameter that you make?
Okay, the smallest diameter, we go from a 0.750, which is 3/4 inch, and that is the casings for dynamite. And then we can go all the way up to 20 inch. Right now, the biggest inside diameter that we're producing is 14 inch. It actually holds wire rope. Wire rope is a big account of ours that that we sell to.
And then as far as the length of the tubes, you can make that. Are you limited on how long you can make
limited.
One?
We are limited as to how you can ship it. A 53-footer is about the longest truck that you can get. We could make a tube 53-foot if we needed to.
So let's talk a little bit about shipping. Do you ship primarily within the United States? Do you ship globally? Where do your products go when they leave this facility?
Primarily, the shipping of our tubes go into the four-state area. I would say 80% of our business is in the four-state area, that being Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska. We do ship into Arkansas. We ship into Minnesota. We ship into Illinois. We've had several shipments overseas. We have shipped to Argentina. Most of those tubes are sold out of distributors. They do boxes, they do tubes, they do plastic, they do shrink wraps, they do all the packaging for their products. Those accounts come to us. We supply the tube portion of that. And that's when we get into those international shipments like that. We do have our own truck fleet. We may send our driver out with 11 drops on a truck. We do big circles. We try to, you know, hit different states or different parts of the state and make big circles. And it's very effective. Plus, we pick up some income off of trucking. So,
as your truck is coming back from a drop, will they pick up other miscellaneous freight?
All of our adhesives is picked up by our own truck. Our paper all comes out of Chattanooga.
I'm sure we'll see this when we do our tour, but is part of the service that you offer printing on those tubes, or are they just a blank tube when they leave this facility?
We do offer printing, one color printing. We do have two printers in-house. Printing is probably 20% of our business. We do a lot of outside white without printing. A lot of mail order people like the white shipping tubes. So we do quite a bit of that.
So they're white as opposed to the craft paper,
right?
Brown.
Brown. Something I might mention, we are 100% recycled. That's all we use. We recycle in-house. We actually bale all of our scrap and send it back. And it's a great concept. You know, you buy it for like $595 a ton and you sell it back for $35. It's great. But, you know.
Yeah,
but we do recycle.
It's a little off there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little offset there, just a little.
But as a responsible manufacturer, you have to be responsible to the environment.
Oh, yes.
And
right.
And do that recycling.
And we do something at this company. I'm on the advisory board over in Maryville for recycling. And I enjoy that post a lot because I think environmentally about what's happening here anyway. But we take in from our customers at no charge. And we've got a couple of accounts that they scrapped their tubes and they were throwing them in the landfills we actually pick those up. We bring them back here and we recycle them and bale them.
Well, that's a great service because you mentioned that your truck is coming back empty anyway.
Right.
So why not bring the spent tubes
right
out of rolls of tape?
Exactly. Everyone that we sell the paper back to, doesn't matter, cardboard boxes and paper tubes, you know, it's all the same type, recycled paper. And so we bale it up and we send it out. Yeah, I make a few bucks on per ton getting it out of here. It probably doesn't pay the manpower that I pay to run the muncher and to actually bale it, but it's something we do for the environment.
So. Sure, that's the right thing to do.
It is.
Tell me about your employees. How many people do you employ at this facility?
We employ 24. I have a wonderful team here. The sales force, I'd put them up against anyone. They're really good, and it's showing because we are growing.
And do you draw people from primarily here in Albany, or do they come from 20, 30 miles outside town to come in here and work?
I would say 80% of them are pretty local. My son and I, Heath, works here at the company. We're the longest traveling. We live in Maryville. We have a few from over by Bethany, New Hampton, and then Grant City, and we have some here in Albany, or most of them are here in Albany. I would say they're all within a 20-mile radius.
Well, it's such a benefit to have a manufacturing company in a small town like Albany that provides jobs, but about 80% of your workforce is here in this immediate area, so those dollars are just going right back into the local economy.
They are. Yes, they are.
Back in 2008, when we had the downturn in the economy, did your business continue to grow during that time period, or did
No.
you really have to knuckle down and make it work?
We had to knuckle down. Actually, 2009 was the first time that I was involved in what I would consider a sizable layoff. That was tough. I don't ever want to do that again. These people needed their jobs, and I pride myself in the fact that what I want to do here is create jobs. When we bought the company, I think there were 16 employees. We're at 24. I wanted to continue. And 09 was bad. Actually, it started the end of 08. 09 was really tough. We had no growth there. Actually, we lost. And it went into 10, and then it started bouncing back. And when it came back strong. And we've had steady growth in profits. It took me from 2002 when we bought the company. It took me for about 5 years to figure out the mix of the product here that was the most beneficial for this company to grow. We're seeing profits that we hadn't seen before, yet sales dollars, they're up, but not extreme amounts, but the profits are what I would consider very favorable. You know, there's a lot of rewards. There's a lot of headaches, a lot of stress, but yet there's a lot of rewards. So I think the rewards offset anything that you go through, other than a tornado. I don't want to do that again.
Have you been through that?
Oh, yes, in 04.
Okay,
yes.
So tell us about that.
That was like, you take everything for granted when you come in here every day, and everything's running. We built the new building in back, and that's one thing. When you drive across 136 and you look at our company, it doesn't look real big. It used to be the old Pepsi Cola bottling company is what we used to be. The tornado, when it came, it was two small F1s. One was on the north and one was on the south. And when it got down here to BTC Bank or around that area, they came together. And when it went through and it caught Hy-Vee and us, it was, I think they rated it an F4. I know that we made the video for that year anyway. We had just, on the 21st of May, did the walkthrough on our new building. And everything was fine, you know, and that was on a Friday, the 21st, and on Monday, the 24th, the tornado hit. We had just set up the electrical to be installed, and we were putting a new roof, and we were putting new sides and everything on the building.
So you had no equipment in the building.
And no equipment in there, and it was a lifesaver that we had that building because all the other buildings were not operable. We had to have somewhere to move to, and so we moved to the new building. The new building was actually going to be warehouse. It was going to house raw goods, and it was going to house finished goods. It is now the major part of the production here. We had to move it there, and we were not going to spend the money to move it back, so we were 13 months recovering from it. It was a growing experience, and it was a learning experience. I call it my $2 million nightmare, and it was a $2 million nightmare. And when a storm cloud comes now, the employees don't laugh at me anymore.
Well, you almost no sooner you bought the business in 2003. A tornado wiped you out in 2004. The economy tanked in 2008. So you're just now starting to reap the benefits of owning your own business.
I will say it's been tough.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was, we actually bought it in June of 02, but we didn't even have it 2 full years.
People drive by this company every single day. They have no idea really what you do or where the products go. So that's why we'd like to give you the opportunity to talk about your company and what they do. So with that, what's the primary thing in closing that you'd like for people to know about GHS Paper Tube and Core?
Probably that it is a family-oriented type operation. We care about our employees. We care that they have a job tomorrow. We care if they have a job in two years. We want to continue to grow. And I'd like to see just, you know, steady growth in profits like we've been having. So I'm living my dream. All those years that I was traveling around and you know, I always thought I would want to own a manufacturing company. Now, I'm not sure that paper tubes is what I was thinking in that dream, but, you know, we've got there, so it's going good.
If you can make a living at what you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah, that is very true.
Well, I'm glad that you're finally seeing some success, and thank you very much for having us come out this morning. We'll look forward to taking our tour of your facility and seeing just exactly how these paper tubes and cores come together.
Well, we look forward to taking you out there.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Diane Higdon, owner and president of GHS Paper Tube and Core in Albany, Missouri. Diane told me that in addition to the tornado, they also survived a fire 3 years ago. Despite a few setbacks, the company has continued to grow under her leadership. In fact, she's contemplating opening a second facility somewhere out west and is currently scouting locations. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Diane's son and operations manager, Heath Higdon, will take us on a tour of the facility so we can learn how rigid tubes and cores are made. Stick around.
Support for Spotlight on Industry on KXCV KRNW comes from Nottoway County Economic Development, coordinating economic development services for the City of Maryville, Nottoway County, and the Maryville Industrial Development Corporation. Their services include finance and incentives development, site location, industrial development, and small business assistance. More at maryvillemo.org. And from Mazinga Lake Recreation Park, the park offers residents and visitors camping facilities for tents and RVs, as well as lakeside cabin rentals. Mazinga Lake also offers boating, fishing, hiking, and equestrian trails. More information about Mazingo is at mazingalake.com. Support also comes from the City of Maryville, Missouri, offering residents and visitors opportunities in education, employment, healthcare, and recreation, as well as agricultural, industrial, retail, and professional services. More information about the City of Maryville is at www.maryville.org.
Welcome back to Spotlight on Industry. If you're just joining us, we've been visiting with Diane Higdon of GHS Paper Tube and Core in Albany, Missouri. GHS manufactures rigid tubes and cores for use in shipping, adhesives, aluminum foil, and the explosives industry. One of the things I find fascinating about touring manufacturing facilities is that it really gives a person the chance to see good old-fashioned American ingenuity at work. For instance, it's long been said that necessity is the mother of invention. Well, at some point in the early history of GHS, someone had the need to make a paper tube, so they built their own machine to carry out the task. The first tube winder we watched operate was originally built from the ground up using the hydrostatic drive from a John Deere combine as its power source. All the parts and pieces were handmade based on traditional design of the equipment. In this case, an ingenious person decided that he could build a tube winding machine of his own, and he set to work on the task. Well, that machine has been going strong for 33 years, and we got a chance to watch it in action. Our tour guide was operations manager Heath Higdon. We started in the warehouse among 5-foot-tall rolls of paper. Heath, tell us a little bit about the paper that we're seeing.
All of our paper raw materials come from Chattanooga, Tennessee. We get widths of 2-inch, 4-inch, and 5-inch paper, calipers of 16-point up to 42-point, and that's how we build our tubes. We have to use different widths so that the gaps don't line up and build up our thickness. So,
the wall thickness that Heath refers to is the actual thickness of the side of the tube. If you were to slice a tube in half and look at the end of it, you'd notice how thick the edge is. The thicker the wall, the sturdier the tube. The diameter of the tube that Heath refers to is the inside of the tube rather than the outside. Each tube consists of anywhere from 3 to 17 layers or plies of paper that are of varying thickness. The thickness of the paper is referred to in the industry as caliper and is measured in points rather than inches. A 16-point paper is roughly half the thickness of a 30-point paper. Heath describes the basics of how the tubes are constructed.
You get 16-point, you'll get 18-point, you'll get 30-point, we get 38-point, and we get 42-point. And the different thicknesses make how we get our wall thickness. We'll start usually with an 18 point, then we'll go to 30 points, and then we'll end with a 16 point on top.
So you have different calipers of paper that go into a single tube.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for like our thinnest tube, we'll do a ply of 18, three plies of 16. For our thickest tube, we'll do a ply of 18, probably three plies of 38. The rest will all be 42 points, and then we'll cover it with a 16. But we have to do the thinner on the top and the bottom so that the paper doesn't crumple.
GHS does have a brand new factory-built winder in another part of the facility that was just installed back in February, and its layout and function is pretty much the same as the original hand-built machine we toured, which they call Winder 1.
It's the biggest winder we have in our facility. It does anywhere from 2-inch diameter up to 14-inch diameter.
When a person touring the facility gets their first look at this homemade tube winding machine, it might best be described as a contraption. My hat's off to the person who built this machine, because it is a complicated series of feeders, rollers, belts, and other moving parts. The job we're about to watch on Winder 1 was for a customer that would ultimately wind plastic around the tubes. They'll have a 3/8 inch thick wall and be cut into initial lengths of 81 inches. In a later process, they'll be cut down to a finished length of about 4.5 inches. Before each job starts to run, all the paper for that job must be staged at the machine. The rolls of paper are sorted by width and caliper and then stood vertically so they can be picked up by a custom-built hand truck, rolled up to the machine, and lifted into place. This job requires 13 rolls of paper that would make up the 13 plies of the tube. Now, these 13 rolls are loaded side by side and they stand up vertically. They're in a specific order based on the width and caliper of each roll. This is determined by the order in which the plies build up on the wall of the tube. The ends of each roll are fed up and over a series of rollers, with each one being progressively higher than the next. They take a left turn and then continue back down the length of the machine until they are basically stacked atop one another, but are slightly offset and not touching. From there, they go through a glue application, which Heath explains.
So the back of here, you can see this is where the tube actually starts coming together. We use a cascade gluing system. They put the glue on the top ply, and then that is scraped down, and everything just cascades down from there. So every ply drops down to the next ply with glue. And then also on this backside here, you can see the tallow that we use. That's just to lubricate the bottom ply as it goes across the mandrel.
The glue they use is a mixture of clay, boric acid, phosphoric acid, and a defoaming agent. The glue that drips off the bottom ply falls back into a vat and is recycled through the process. The tallow that Heath mentioned is a waxy substance that is applied to the bottom side of the first ply. This ply makes up the inside of the tube, and the tallow, which is a mixture of paraffin and animal fat, serve as a lubricant so the tube will slide off the form. Now, the form on which these tubes are wound is called a mandrel. It's made of steel, hollow, tubular shape, and its outside diameter is equal to the inside diameter of the paper tube. It sits horizontally on the machine and is attached to a spindle on one end. There's a rubber belt attached to the machine's drive mechanism that loops around the mandrel in a figure eight configuration. The belt puts friction on the mandrel, causing it to spin. The glued up plies of paper are fed between the belt and the mandrel diagonally so that they form a spiral. This not only pulls the paper through the machine, but more importantly, it compresses the individual layers. There's one final top layer of paper that goes on the tube, but it doesn't run under the belt. Since the belt is made of rubber, it leaves a black mark on the outside of the tube. That final top layer is applied after the belt and provides a nice, clean surface. The outside is coated with paraffin to remove any dust, and then it's cut to length. Heath explains.
So basically what happens after it comes through the belt, comes down here to this cutter. Now this cutter runs off of an encoder, which is calculating how many inches of the bottom ply have gone through the machine. From that information, the machine translates it and cuts it to whatever length that we're doing. So once, you know, 81 inches goes through, it knows to cut.
As the tubes are cut, They roll down onto an inclined table where an operator stacks them off onto a cart, and they are taken away to the next step of the process, which is to cut them to their final length. Now, I mentioned earlier that GHS does have a new tube winder that is still being broken in. It is configured much like the older one, but it's computer controlled and holds tighter tolerances for the final cuts. So much so that much of what comes off it is ready to ship, thereby saving time and money. Many of the tubes and cores GHS produces get cut down into customer-specified lengths. They have recently installed computerized cutting equipment that hold tolerances better than their old manual machines, thereby reducing costs. As we were watching those machines run, there was one other machine that caught my eye, so I asked Heath about it.
The machine you see here is what puts the crimp in the dynamite. So what we do is we'll take a stick of the dynamite that we run off the machine. It goes in the top, and this is a homemade machine. It goes in the top, it's got a drum cutter that cuts it to a certain length, and then drops it down in, and then it'll go through another system that puts the crimp on the end of it. The best way to describe it is the old BB canisters that they used to put BBs in before they went to plastics is what we do. We put a rosette crimp in it, and what that does is hold the TNT in the tube.
The tubes that are used for dynamite are about 3/4 inch in diameter and 24 inches long. Although they only produce the tubes at GHS, Heath went on to explain how the sticks of dynamite are made.
So they'll take this and put it in a machine that sits it straight up and down. They have a tube that comes right in the top of it, fills it full of trinitroglycerin or TNT, and then they put a cap on the top of it, and then they put a fuse through the cap. We make the caps for them, but we don't put them on. It's just a paper disc that goes over the top. It's got a perforation in the middle, and they stick the wick through that. And it makes a big bang.
I bet it does.
We have made another one that was 8 inches in diameter, and they filled it full of dynamite. That would be a boom.
That'd make a mess, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yep. That would. It'd be fun to see, though.
I can imagine them using that in like a rock quarry.
Yeah.
Something where they were blasting out limestone.
Yep. And they were, those big ones, they were setting 6 of them up at a time and blowing 6 of those things at one time. So you could just imagine the debris that was going everywhere.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, me too.
The individual tubes that are used for dynamite have some printing on them that consists of a brand name and a warning label. I asked Keith if they do that printing in-house.
We do print here. We do one color. We do all of our printing offline. Some places do it right on the winder, but we prefer to do it offline. It gives us a little bit more control over it. It's a continuous roll. You can see the printers. We're standing by them now. We put the roll of paper on the back side. There's another pulley on the front that pulls it and winds it back up onto a roll. You have less ability to have a problem with your print. Once the winder's going, you don't ever stop. You just want to keep going. So this way, print it offline, we can keep an eye on it and make sure there's no imperfections in it.
The final operation Heath shared with us was recycling and their shredder that is affectionately called the Muncher. Although it wasn't in operation the day we visited, Heath said that they create 1,200-pound bales of recyclable material from overruns, defective tubes, and scraps that they pick up from some of their customers. It's funny, we don't think much about that tube in the center of our aluminum foil or the roller that's left over after the tape runs out, but they do play a vital role in their respective industries. They all have to come from somewhere, and as we found out today, many of them come from GHS Paper Tube and Core in Albany, Missouri. Well, next, I'm pleased to announce a new feature on our show. From time to time, my producer, Karen Lawrence, will be going out on assignment to spotlight those companies that operate on a smaller scale, but nonetheless produce valuable and sometimes divine goods and services. This month, she had a chance to visit the Benedictine Sisters of Perpetual Adoration in Clyde, Missouri, to learn about their long-standing tradition of making altar breads.
For most of us, at one time or another, we have participated in a communion service at church. In many Christian denominations, the bread we partake is symbolic of the body of Christ. In the Catholic faith, once the bread is blessed by the priest, it becomes the body of Christ. You may not have given much thought about where that bread comes from, but, as we found out recently, much of it comes from the Sisters of Perpetual Adoration in Clyde, Missouri. I had a chance to sit down with their altar breads manager, Sister Linda Souza, to learn about their long-standing history of baking these breads that are central to the Catholic faith. Today we are sitting here with Sister Lynn D'Souza of the Benedictine Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. Thank you for sitting with us.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for talking to me.
So Sister Lynn, to start us off with this one, can you tell us a little bit about the history here at the monastery?
Our monastery was founded actually in 1874. We came from a group of sisters in Switzerland, and we originally came at the request of our brothers at Conception Abbey to help with work with some of the German immigrants in the area. But we quickly realized that our German speaking skills were not needed and we needed to learn English. And we really wanted to set up a place of prayer for our nation, for our world, and found this to be the ideal place to do it.
And so you guys produce altar breads here. So can you tell us a little bit about when and why you started that?
Our name is Benedictine Sisters of Perpetual Adoration, and from the beginning, the Eucharist has been very important to us. So we make the breads that become the Eucharist at Mass. We started in 1910, and really it was a way just to provide something that we needed for our liturgical services, and that became a way to provide for the local church, and it has just grown and become a source of income for us to support our ministry of prayer.
Okay, and do these breads ship nationally, internationally?
We have two types of breads. Our regular altar breads, which are made of wheat flour and water, and are used by the majority of, you know, Catholic churches, that type of bread. We also make a low-gluten altar bread. Our regular altar breads are shipped all over the United States and to Canada, but our low-gluten altar breads are actually shipped all over the world. We've sent them as far away as Japan, Australia, South America, Mexico, really quite expansive.
And so you say this has become a source of income for you guys. So how are those funds used around the monastery?
They support our life. From those funds, we would pay for the healthcare costs for sisters, our food, utility bills, the maintenance of our buildings, our groundkeeping. We do have some lay employees, and so our income also goes towards their salaries. Really, all the facets of our life, everything we need to run this monastery comes from the funds that we raise.
And so who is it here that are making those altar breads?
We do have several lay employees. I have about 14 on my staff, but I also have, I think, 8 sisters that work in the department that help us produce the altar breads.
And is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about the monastery or the altar breads in general?
Our mission really is prayer for the church and for the world, and so we welcome anyone in the area that would like to join us for our church services to please do so, and to know that our goal really is to be a source of prayer for the world.
After talking with Sister Lynn, she led us on a tour of the facility where they make altar breads. The monastery grounds are quite large, and the altar breads are baked in a building that is separate from the main building that houses the Relic Chapel and the Adoration Chapel. She led us outside, and as we walked, we were introduced to the beauty surrounding the monastery, such as the guest houses, farm buildings, and what's left of the beautiful pine trees that the Benedictine sisters brought with them to America. Once we were inside the altar bread facility, Sister Lynn brought us to the flower room, where the process begins.
Okay, so this is our flower room. We have both whole wheat and white flour. Our white altar breads are made with just the white flour. Our whole wheat breads use a mix of the both. The machine here, we call it, it's a tube there, so we program in the amount of flour that we want, and it creates a suction and automatically moves the flour we need through these pipes into the room next door, which is our mixing room. One mix is about 95 pounds of flour and 16 gallons of water. We do between 10 and 14 mixes a day. So this is the mixing room. The flour would come in here into these pipes and the water is added here. It's a turbo mixer, so it mixes very quickly. And then we, from that tank that it's mixed in, it gets poured into these two carts that are rolled over to our baker. At this point, it would be put through a filter or a sieve so that any lumps in the batter, or most of the lumps in the batter, would be taken out. So from the cart, it's hooked up to our baker by a hose, and it gets pumped up through this little wand, and this the baker has 30 plates. They're kind of like a clamshell, so they open and close. It'll pour 10 strips of batter, 10 little thin strips of batter, and then that plate closes and it'll spread out and make a sheet that's about 10 by 15 inches rectangle. The 30 plates would rotate on this little conveyor belt. It takes about 2 minutes to complete one rotation, so that's the baking time for one sheet of ultra breads. As one sheet is poured, the previous sheet comes off the baker, and then that plate is empty and ready for the next pour. The sheets come off the baker, and they go on this like little Ferris wheel kind of thing to give them a chance to cool off a little bit before they're stacked up. After the breads have a chance to cool, we take them into the next room, and this would be our first phase of quality control. Each sheet that is baked is looked over. We try to remove any imperfections. Sometimes a little bit of a clump of batter would get in there, or a little burn spot, something dark. If we can remove it from the sheet and use most of the sheet, we will do that. If we can only save a part of the sheet, we will save that sheet. We do have some special size breads that we cut by hand, and we can use the partial sheets for that. We try to limit the waste as much as we can, but obviously there will be some waste in the process. So after the breads are baked, they come off the baker and they're very crisp, like ice cream cone. So if we tried to cut them in that condition, the breads would break fairly easily. They're very fragile. So we do have to put some moisture into the breads. And we put them in what we call our atomizing room. They're loaded on special racks that have a lot of holes cut into the shelving of them. And the breads are stacked on there, and they stay in the atomizing room overnight. And during that time, there's a fine mist of water that's spraying, and fans going to move that air around the room. So in that moist atmosphere, the breads will absorb some of that water, and it makes them very pliable and much easier to cut. So when the breads are ready to cut, some of our staff will take them out of the atomizing room, and we have a couple different sizes. Our largest size, which we call the concelebration hosts, are about 5.5 inches in diameter. So those are cut singly, one sheet at a time, and there's a special machine that puts a little imprint on the breads so that they can be more easily broken. So those sheets are cut on this cutter, and all the breads then, after they're cut, get looked over. If we can remove the imperfections on the breads, we do so. If we can't, then that bread is lost to us. So that would be for those size breads. The people's breads, or the smaller size, are cut in the drill press cutters that we have here. So these frames hold about 100 of those sheets, of the sheets that we were talking about before. And this blade is rotating, and it's programmed for the size of breads that we're cutting. So it'll move automatically to the space it needs to go, and the blade will just drop down through the whole stack of sheets, and then that little plunger will drop, and the breads will drop out onto the conveyor belt behind the cutter. From that conveyor belt, they go up through a series of tumblers to help remove some of the broken pieces of the breads, and then onto a longer conveyor belt where the sisters or some of the employees would sit and look over the breads as they go through. Again, we're looking for maybe rough edges, dark spots. Anything that would be a detraction if you were receiving that bread in communion is something we'd want to remove. Broken breads, etc. The obvious flaws we would also remove. The breads are then packaged in bags of 500, and then they're sealed and they're taken back to our shipping room. So, we ship breads all over the United States. Our low-gluten breads, which are produced in a separate area, because of the wheat flour that we use and the dust, we produce our low-gluten breads in a completely separate area so that we can tell our customers they've been in a gluten-free environment and that they can be assured of the quality of their breads haven't been contaminated by the flour and stuff that we use in our regular breads. So the low-gluten breads we actually ship all over the world. We've shipped them as far away as Australia, Japan. Our regular altar breads we send to many parishes within the United States and also to some in Canada. We also sell to other religious communities wholesale breads that they either repackage and redistribute, or we already package them and they'll just sell them to customers too. In a way, it's a way for us to help them support their religious life as well.
Okay, so how many points of quality control do you have throughout the system?
There would be at least 5 or 6 points of quality control. Until, from the moment the sheet comes off the baker until that bread is put in a box and that box is taped up to be sent out, we're always looking at the breads, we're always looking at the bags to make sure that the breads that are in those bags and the breads that are cut are of the highest quality.
And so how many of these do you ship out, you know, on average a week?
It's hard to say, but we make 2 million ultra breads a week, about 9 million a month. So that's probably pretty close to what we ship out in that period of time as well.
All right, and so what is the shelf life for these ultra breads?
Because of the low moisture content in the breads, the shelf life is probably about 6 months. They're very shelf stable. We do keep some breads in our freezer to help us in the times when we have high demand for breads like Christmas and Easter. And I would say in the freezer, breads could easily last up to a year. But because we have a fairly high turnover rate, our breads don't stay on the shelf more than 2 or 3 weeks.
All right, and so some of the equipment is kind of made by people, by your workmen or by the sisters. Can you tell us a little bit about some of that?
Yeah, we're the largest religious producer of ultra breads in the United States, and I would probably say in the world. There are some commercial companies that produce them in the U.S., but as far as religious sisters producing them, we're the largest. So it's not always easy to get equipment that we need. So some of the equipment you've seen here, the little Ferris wheel rack to dry the sheets, the tumblers that help us sort the breads, those were thought of and developed and made by our sisters and our workmen here on our property to help facilitate the process of making the ultra breads. More recently, our drill press cutters that we use have been running on a DOS-based computer program, and as we know, that's pretty outdated, and we've had some hard times finding replacement parts for those. So one of our sisters, who's quite gifted, has been working on programming a new computer to run our drill presses, and she's got like a touchscreen computer, and I think she's using a Linux-based program, and so we're really glad to be able to update our cutters.
It was comforting to watch the sisters hand make these ultra breads. Their thoughts and prayers are constantly going into the ultra breads, just as they go into anything else the sisters make. During our tour of the monastery, their director of communications, Kelly Baldwin, took us to a gift shop to show us all the other things the sisters create. They make soaps, lotions, pottery, and even hiking sticks made from the salvaged wood of their beloved pine trees. These sisters put all of their love, care, and prayers into their work, helping them to accomplish their mission of perpetual adoration.
I can't begin to think of the number of times I've taken communion in my life, and not once did I stop to think about where the host came from. It's nice to know that it's made with such love and care right here in my own backyard. I'd like to thank our guests this month, GHS Paper Tube and Core President Diane Higdon and Operations Manager Heath Higdon. I'd also like to thank Sister Lynn D'Souza of the Benedictine Sisters of Perpetual Adoration for showing us what goes into the making of altar breads for Holy Communion. Join us next month as we hit the road and head north of Maryville to Shenandoah, Iowa, where we will visit with Deanna Anderson of Earl May Seed and Nursery. Once again, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next month as we shine the spotlight on industry.
Support for Spotlight on Industry comes from Nottoway County Economic Development, Mazingo Lake Recreation Park, and the City of Maryville. More information on all of our sponsors is available at MarylandMO.org. Spotlight on Industry is a production of KXCV-KRNW and Northwest Missouri State University. Our editor and producer is Karen Lawrence. For more information about how your company can be featured on Spotlight on Industry, please contact Sam Mason at 660-562-1163.